So what I'd like to explain is a chazal that Rashi mentions on Kehelas, and has to do with Bereshis. I mean, I'd like to show where exactly Kehelas fits in. Of course, Kehelas does have to do with Sheishis and Bereshis. So Rashi says, Havel Avolam Amar Kehelas. So Rashi says, Kehelas, it's on Pasuk Beis. Kehelas Kori Kagor. Va'omer al kol yitziras shivas yimei bereshis sha'akol havel shel avolamo. So, I mean, the question is, I mean, what does it have to do with shivas yimei bereshis? I mean, havel shel, all of Kehelas really has to do with the personal life of man. And the essence of Kehelas is to show that there really is nothing that a person can do to find psychological happiness. Psychological happiness, what a person is looking for in the psychological, is not possible. In the because the psych, I will get it a little more exactly, but basically that's the whole Sefer Kehelas, is to show that man is, it's a havo shel avolam. Because it means that the person is engaged in striving, endless striving, and all his energies are placed, all the psychological energies are invested, and heavily invested, and it's invested in nothing, and something that doesn't exist, a complete fantasy. So that's really the Sefer, and the Sefer shows in every possible way how that outcome is. That a person is looking for he's looking for something, and basically, the reality wipes it all out. I mean, reality wipes it all out. You could say that in Kehelas Gimel, for instance, where he talks about Kimikra, the pasuk Yitzes, Kimikra v'nei Adam Mikra Behema Mikra Echad Lakol Lahem Kmo Zeh Kein Mo Zeh Ruach Echad Lakol. So he means to say that basically what a person is striving for is something that he can feel, that he has something, and he has nothing. As a matter of fact, even the greatest chacham mikra or the mikra behemo, and then he mentions many times that the lamo chachamti oz yoser ki mikra echad lakol, even the greatest chacham, the end is misa, and misa basically wipes everything out. So he can't have any satisfaction or any feeling that he has something which he's striving for. Is simply unattainable. It's not reality. He works and he puts his energies into it because of a certain fantasy and illusion of success, but in reality it's non-existent, and a part of him always knows that, and therefore he's never could really be happy because his mind always, like the Ibn Ezra says, Hamavis bein einav tamid. So this is essentially. The system is set up where basically his striving, the end goal for everything that he's striving for, is non-existent, and his mind is aware of that. So he says, don't tell me about Olam Haba, because he says Mi yodea ruach b'nei adam olei lamalav ruach b'nei redesi lamatal aretz. Which basically means that Olam Haba, the true idea of Olam Haba, is something that requires great knowledge, and it's not something which is psychologically satisfying. It is a mistake that people make, that what they do is that they tell themselves that it's all worth it for Olam Haba. But the Olam Haba that is a reality, the Mi yodea, is not the thing that the emotions are looking for. And so he cryptically, he doesn't want to reveal. I mean, Kehelas is very hidden. The way he has double entendres, you don't know what he means. Gamze article. You don't know whether he means the statement or the thing. Very hidden the way he wrote it. But basically what he's saying is that the Olam Haba of fantasy that the emotions are striving for is non-existent. The real Olam Haba, it's true, it exists, but that is not something which is satisfying to the drive, for the drive of man. The drive of man is the Olam Haba that is satisfying for the drive of man is the Olam Haba of the Umos Olam. The prototype is the happy hunting grounds. I mean, that concept of Olam Haba, which most people are attached to in some modified form, is basically the thing which is satisfying for man on a psychological plane. But in reality, that doesn't exist either. That's just a total fantasy. The Olam Haba that does exist, the Miyodea, is that Nefesh Adam Oli Lamala and Nefesh Ben Oli Redesi Lamata Lort. That one, it's true, it exists, but if a person has knowledge of it, if he's a Yodea, he knows that that is not satisfying the urge that propels him through life to have something. It's a completely different phenomenon. So that's why it concludes, V'ra'isi ki ein tov me'asher yismach adam b'ma'asav ki hu chelko, that happiness is only possible in an activity in this life. But the only thing that is the thing that is closest, that brings man closest to psychological happiness, is happiness which involves an activity, the activity itself, but not the having. The having and the possessing and the feeling that a person really is looking for, that I have something, I've achieved something, there is something here, that is a complete illusion, and he could never enjoy it. And so far as he's intelligent, he knows that it's completely mythical. So that's why he says, "V'risi ki ein tov me'asher yismach adam b'masav ki hu chalko." The acts themselves, that's the only chelik he has. Ki mi yivienu liros b'mesh yiyeh acharav, because he's going to die, and once he dies, whatever he has no control over, and since he has no control over it, even in the fantasy that he would be able to enjoy it were it something real, he doesn't even have that, you see. Because the mind of a person is so strange that he looks for a kind of immortality, and he's attracted to immortality with such a great force that even though he knows he can't enjoy it, he still will strive for it. That's why man strives to build buildings, to have his name on buildings, to be a part of history, which is something which he never can enjoy. But the force of the desire to have something eternal is so powerful that he's attracted to it, even though he knows he can never enjoy it. But even that, he says, even that fantasy can't really, even as a fantasy, it's not even complete. Because he knows, even in the fantasy, me v'yem liros, mashiachrav, it's something which he has no control over. So even as a fantasy, as a hevel in itself, but even in its own framework of hevel, it is not even something that he can entertain in any intelligent way. So basically, he's doomed in terms of that, that kind of a desire for success or happiness about the self. So the whole Sefer Kehelis is basically, that's basically what it is. So the question is, I mean, if that's the case, so what does it mean that he's Kore Tag al Shivasi Mebrashis? And what's got to do with Shivasi Mebrashis? It has to do basically with psychology. Yeah. Kore Tag al Omal Kol Yitzira Shivasi Mebrashis Shakol Havo Shalav Olamet. So that's the question. But we'll get back to that. But anyways, what I wanted to say is, where does Kehelis enter? And where does Kehelis enter? Basically, Kehelis enters in Yetziras HaOdom. But Yetziras HaOdom really after the fall of Adam. After his fall. And before his fall, Kehelis is not talking about the enjoyment of Chachma. Enjoyment of Chachma is something which he's not discussing. And that's why Chazal say that Ma'aseh Lo Adam Chol Amor Shi'amal Tachas Hashemesh Tmuras HaTorah Sheikru Yor Shenemar HaTorah Or Kol Amor Shi'um Machlis Bo Es Eisek HaTorah Ma Socher Bo. So he's not talking about kind of individual that's engaged constantly in Chachmas Hashem. That's not his, insofar as man's engaged in Chachmas Hashem, that's not his, he's not discussing that. He's discussing the psychological energies of man. So that's basically the area of Kehelis. So the question is, what does that have to do with Shivas Mei Breishis? That's the question. But where does Kehelis enter? Kehelis really enters, his entry into Sefer Breishis, into Parshas Breishis, is really after the fall of Adam. See, after the fall of Adam. And after the fall of Adam, the way the Torah describes the fall of Adam is interesting, because the Torah says like this, that after his fall, once he gave in to the lure of the Eitz Hadas, and that changed his psychological orientation, his energies then became fixed in the lust of Taiva. So the on all levels, basically. So then it says that that he realized a new institution was created in him, which was a sense of worthlessness and shame, and he realized that he was naked, which was the conscience, the entity of conscience, what we call conscience. You know, what the psychologists define as the superego is the thing that came into, became a part of his nature. But interesting is that what happened, it says, Vayishmo eskola Hashem alakim mesalech bagom and roch hayom, Vayishcha be'odam vishnu ne'er Hashem alakim mesalech etzagon. The next passage says, Vayikra Hashem alakim ala adam, Vayom ala ayeka. So he answered, Vayomar, and he answered, Eskol choshamati bagon. So Adam Arishon answered the question. He said, "I realized that I was hiding because I realized I'm naked and it's not roy, it's not appropriate." Once he had that sense, it's not appropriate to stand before the Shekhinah without any clothing. So Kadosh Baruch Hu answered him, "Leilam mi higid l'cha ki eramata." So he was caught by the question of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So of course Adam Arishon was a tremendous chacham, as a great chacham, as a matter of fact, when it says about Shlomo HaMelech in Malachim Aleph, so it says that he was Vayechkam Mikol Adam Me'esan HaAzrachi, that's in Malachim Aleph in Hey Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayechkam Mikol Adam Me'esan HaAzrachi V'Heimun V'Chalko V'Dardar B'nei Mocho V'Yishmo B'Chol HaGayim Sovet. So the Medrash says, Mikol Adam Ze Adam Rishon, Eisun Az Rachi Ze Avram, Haman Ze Moshe, Achalkal Ze Yosef, the Dada Ze Dar Midbar. So the first one that I mentioned is Adam Rishon. So Adam Rishon was really a chacham, was from the greatest chachamim that ever existed. So the question is, I mean, if he was such a great chacham, how did he get trapped by that answer? I mean, the moment he said that Va'irah, he had one mitzvah, and the mitzvah was not to eat from the Eitz Hadas. So then he ate from the Eitz Hadas, and he realized that he was naked. So he realized he was naked. It's not right to be able to smash Shekhinah that way, because that new sense came into him. So then when HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked him, where are you, Ayeka, he says, "It's kol chashmati v'gam v'irkei v'kerem v'nech v'yachavei." So then he was caught immediately. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, So he was such a great chacham. So how is it possible that he fell into that trap? I mean, it seems like a rather simple trap. The moment you say that, he gives the answer that he realized that he had a new, something happened to him. He had a new sense, because at first it says that he walked in the gun and he was very, he was fine. The Yishnei Rumum Adam Yishnei Valayis by Shafi. So he should have realized that that's not a good answer. He's going to get trapped. Yeah, so what is the answer to that question? The answer to that question is basically that the new... You see, before the chait, he was able to look at himself and to study himself just like he could study anything in the creation. The self was another object of study, just like anything else. So that's why he started to study the different animals, and he saw everyone has a zivug, and he himself saw that he was lacking. He was studying himself. He was able to study himself as an object. But the moment he was a chote, and this sense of conscience entered, a new sense about the self. This isn't term conscience, but basically it's a new sense about the self. The sense about the self was so overpowering that all his energies, that became the repository of all his energies. So the moment that became the repository of all his energies, he could only be concerned about that self and his reaction to events that took place with regard to the self. The self became the center. All the energies were centered in the self. So if something happened with regard to the self, that absorbed all the energies. Once that absorbed all the energies, the logical analysis of the self became completely obsolete. It was unable to do it. So when he heard the call at Hashem Elokim, Mishalech Bagon L'Ruach Hayom, and he sensed that sense of busha, the shame was overpowering, and that there was no energy left for him to think logically about himself before, and now he changed, and how could he give this answer? Because this answer, he's going to be trapped, because he's going to be revealing, in essence, the thing that he's most afraid of revealing, namely that he was a chote. Because that was the real sense of shame and nakedness, like Chazal say, Rashi said, well, he had one mitzvah, then it's atlan in that. So he fell into the trap of admitting unwillingly that he was basically a chote. And he was unable to avoid it. With all his intelligence, he was unable to avoid it because he was completely overcome by the energies that were completely wrapped up in the sense of self and his reaction to the Kol at Hashem Elokim, Mishalech Bagon L'Ruach Hayom. That reaction was the Kol at Hashem Elokim, Mishalech Bagon L'Ruach Hayom was a perception, as I mentioned before, it wasn't an intellectual perception. A different kind of perception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was now tainted because it became something which was translated into a psychological kind of a phenomenon. A phenomenon that was tied with his sense of worthlessness and his preoccupation with the self. And all the energies were wrapped up in that preoccupation. Once they became wrapped up in that preoccupation, he couldn't see logically that his answer is a trap, because logically, how did he know this? But the preoccupation with the sense of self and the curlet and his reaction to the curlet of Shem Elokim Mishalech Bagon, the Ruach Hayim, was something that completely absorbed all his psychological energies, and there was nothing left. And even though he was the greatest Chacham, he simply could not avoid it. So he fell into the logical trap. But the whole world came under a completely different way of looking at things. And that, to this day, is really the limud from this, is basically that the most difficult thing for man to do is to look at himself and to study himself in an objective way. I mean, that's his downfall. You see, with regard to the taivas that have to do with something outside the self, those are much more controllable because the sense of self protects them or alerts them to those kind of errors. But when it comes to a study of the self, the individual, the person himself, that is completely blocked. In that area, since that's the repository of all the energies, it becomes almost impossible, and all the chokhmah is lost, and the ability to study the self objectively becomes the most difficult thing for man to do. And in order for man to really rise to a qualitatively differentiated level of existence, that's something he must accomplish. But after the chait of Adam, that became the most difficult thing. And the Torah is showing you this concept, this idea, in Adam himself, who was the greatest chacham, but nevertheless, he fell into the very trap he was trying to avoid, because he was ashamed of the fact that it was a chote. And in his very first remarks, he admitted that he was the greatest chote. And unwillingly admitted, because he was lost in his feelings about his own self-worthiness and worthlessness. His worthiness and his worthlessness became the preoccupation of his whole existence. What is he? And therefore, since that event, that is the greatest challenge for man, the most difficult thing for man to do. He has no institution that can help him over there. There's no institution that can help him over there. As a matter of fact, the institution that he has, which is his conscience, will prevent him from seeing himself in an objective light, because then it'll make him see that he is worthless, his worthlessness. And that's something that conscience tries to avoid. That's exactly what conscience tries to avoid, to give a person a sense of worthlessness. So his preoccupation is always to try to make himself feel worthy. And in trying to make himself feel worthy, he's completely blinded to flaws in his character that really make him worthless. The real true flaws he's blinded from. And that basically is the limud in the parsha. That Adam Rishon, with his great chachma, the chachma can't protect him over here. Chachma over here is simply a tool which does not work, because the energies are completely wrapped up in the need for self-importance. That need for self-importance and the fear of worthlessness is the thing that is precisely the thing that blinds him from any kind of logical analysis of the self. And the Torah shows you this in the instance of Adam Rishon. But what happened over here is that the Adam was changed not only in quality, but in quantity, in terms of how much energy is wrapped up in this sense, which is constantly striving for a feeling of worthiness, for a feeling of a good feeling that he's comfortable with himself, that he's a worthy individual, that he has self-importance. His need for self-importance will always reassert itself, and in many different ways, send out various different ways of establishing his sense of self-importance. But the Kehelis really, and that I think is the answer to the question. You see, the Shivas Yimei Bereishis. Why does it say he's Korei Tagal Shivas Yimei Bereishis? Because Shivas Yimei Bereishis has nothing. What does that have to do with Bria Shemayim V'Aretz? What does that have to do with the Yirikia B'Sach Hamayim? But Rashi is really quoting this from a Medrash. And the Medrash is a Medrash in Medrash Rabbah. Medrash says, Yabir Rab Simon Oma, Shiva HaVolam Oma Kehelas, Keneged Shiva Yimei Bereishis. So it goes through each day. But essentially, what the psukim on each day say is that it will all be eventually be destroyed. But Misham Ksiv, Gracious Bolikim, Shemayim Vesorat. Ksiv, Kishamayim, Kaoshan Nimlachu, Orat Kebeget Tivla. And Besheni Yirakia. And then it says, Niglu Kisefer Shemayim. And Beshlishi Yikov Amayim. And then it says, Vechrim Hashem is Lishon Yamatrayim. Yim Aros, Ksiv, Chofra, Lavona, Vosha Chama. Each one, he shows the destruction, that it's not going to stand la'olam. So what does it mean? He's Kori Tagor. I mean, he has no right to talk against the Shivas Yimei Bereishis. I mean, that's the question, really. What does that have to do with Shivas Yimei Bereishis, and what right does he have to make a judgment on Shivas Yimei Bereishis? That's for God to make a judgment on. God, Pasuk says, V'yamalkim v'yalkim kitov. But the answer is a strange answer. The answer is that what Kehelis is saying is that man is so wrapped up in the need for self-accomplishment and the concept of accomplishment and finding something and feeling that he has something that he can't view anything as being of value if he knows that it's going to be destroyed. It's not going to exist forever, you see. And that's really what that medrash, because that medrash holds that it's a question whether the universe is eternal, it will exist eternally, not eternal in terms of being essentially eternal, that the creation, gracious world, chemistry, shemayim v'azorah. But the question is that once there was a creation, will it be God's will to sustain it eternally or not? This medrash holds not. So modern-day cosmology seems to agree with this medrash, that eventually, when we study the universe, we find that eventually everything will dissipate, and ultimately everything will become a uniform sea of energy. So if that's the case, so everything ultimately will disintegrate and be nothing. So that's the way modern-day cosmology agrees with this medrash. But it's interesting that the cosmologist himself, and as I was reading cosmologists that were discussing this point, couldn't help but enter the sadness of that thought, that eventually everything will be nothing. And it bothered him. It bothered him that, so what is there? So eventually, if everything is, that's true, the whole universe eventually will turn into nothingness. So this planet will be gone, and the sun will reach a point where it burns up everything in its proximity, including Earth, and everything ultimately will become dissipated and become a uniform sea of energy. If that's the case, He lamented over this fact, you know, that then there's nothing for man here. So it shows you an interesting thing. It shows you that what happened to Adam HaRishon after the Chait is something so powerful, so significant psychologically, that even the universe itself, which has nothing to do with him on a personal level, after all, I mean, we're talking about millions and millions of years, millions and millions of years until this happened. But nevertheless, an individual that sees in his mind that this will happen, and even though it's not negaya him personally at all, will feel a sense of remorse about it, because he's so rooted in the emotional need for something that even though he knows he can't have any part in it on a personal level, which would seem to remove any kind of reason for emotional sadness. After all, I mean, sadness and happiness should be based upon the organism. The organism is the only thing that's real on a personal level. Miyachalo miyachish chutz mimeni. That's what the Kabbalah says. I mean, it's on a personal level, that's the only thing that's real psychologically is the existing organism. And this organism, no matter what you're going to say, is not going to be in existence at the time when the universe destructs. So what does he care? It's not going to affect him or his children or his children's children, great-great-grandchildren. It will never affect him. But the fact that ultimately it is doomed is enough to turn him off. on the whole creation. It colors his whole vision of the creation, and he can't find any satisfaction in viewing the creation. It's an interesting thing. But as I was reading this, as I said, this cosmologist was talking about the, you know, what science knows today about cosmology, and how it appears from the study of the universe as we know it today. It does appear that eventually everything will be destroyed, because things are moving, the galaxies are moving apart, and they have either one of two possibilities. Either everything just moves apart and dissipates, or else there's enough gravitational pull to bring everything back to an initial point. But then everything will be destroyed, or there will be no remnant of anything either. Either way the cosmologists look at it, what we know of the universe, what we have, will be no record of, no trace even of it, not even a trace of anything. So that's really the puzzle. That's the puzzle. That Kahelas Kore Tagar Al Shivas Yimei Bereishis Shakol Havol Shel Avolamot. What does it mean? It means to say that he shows that this element in man, the element in man that is in search and in need of finding something of substance so that he could reflect and think that he has something, that there's something here, you see, that need that man has will affect how he looks at the Shivas Yimei Bereishis. And since Adam HaRishon was a Chote, his view of Bereishis has become colored. And he can't even enjoy the universe, and he can't even enjoy his own existence, because he knows ultimately, in a time which is so far removed from his senses and his psyche and his satisfactions, doesn't make any difference. But he's Kore Tagar, Al Shivas Yimei Bereishis. And the entire universe makes him sad, because he knows that ultimately it's going to be nothing. What kind of sense does it make? But it means what he's showing you, basically, Kahelas is showing you, how much of the energy of man is absorbed in this element of his nature, in this institution that man acquired in the Chet of Adam, during the Chet of Adam HaRishon, the institution which is, you call, whatever you call it, conscience, superego, whatever it is, the need for self-worth, that the preoccupation with the self and the need for a sense of self-worth is so powerful that it'll go beyond the rational, which would mean that a person, like what Chazal say, that a person logically only is concerned about Bamini Lenechti, his children, his grandchildren, a certain amount of Doros, that there's a limit to how much emotion a person can attach to his offspring and to a sense of immortality through his offspring. That's true, but it is still so powerful that it even bothers him that the whole creation eventually will be undone. And he can't escape it. He can't escape that feeling, which shows you basically how irrational the structure of the psyche is. And no matter how well a person is psychologically, he still cannot avoid that sense of worthlessness and not only with regard to himself, but even with regard, he must pass judgment on the universe. That's how far-fetched the energy is driven. That he must pass judgment and be sad about the fact that the universe ultimately will cease to exist. So that's really, I believe, the meaning of the Rashi. Kore Tagar V'Omar Kore Tzivos Shizmei Bereishis Shakol Hevel Shalvam. Doesn't mean that he's judging. I mean, that's ridiculous. Him to judge. He's not the creator. How can he judge? Where can he tell? He can't judge that. But he knows he can't judge it. But he's showing that the whole Sefer is about how man's mind, his psyche, is so colored because of the nature of the way the investments of his energies have been changed from the time of the Chet of Adam HaRishon, that it's virtually impossible to escape, and everywhere as he looks, it's painted. And if he's looking at the distant universe, which is millions of years beyond his existence, he's going to feel sad, because he knows that ultimately everything of humanity is going to be destroyed. So what does it make? He probably won't even be remembered after a very short period of time, maybe 100 years. How many people do you know from 100 years ago? So what does he care? But it's that institution is so irrational, it colors everything he sees. And in everything he sees, he looks for that something, that there should be something of permanence. It would give him satisfaction if there's something of permanence, even though it has nothing to do with himself and wouldn't give him a trace of satisfaction psychologically. But the idea that there is at least something, somewhere, is it. But the fact that the universe will ultimately destruct, and that's how that Medrash holds, so that causes him grief and sorrow. It makes him sad. He's Kurei Tagar. He has to be a Kurei Tagar. Adam has to be a Kurei Tagar. Al Shivus and Ebrashis. And that's, I believe, basically what Rashi is quoting that Medrash, because that Medrash really gives you insight into the extent. In Kehelis, it's not just the quality, but in Kehelis, it's the quantity of energy that's the problem. They can't escape, because there are things that are good. Like he says, that Ein Tov L'Adam, Ein Tov B'Adam, it sounds like at one point you're saying it's not so bad. That's good. Yeah, but the problem is, yes, because it is true. That happens to be true. It's wonderful, but it's not gonna do the trick, because the amount of energy that the individual is looking for and his need for a sense of self worth is, and for something, for a sense that there's something here. You see, that there is something here is so great that Masa is not going to do the trick. Yeah, he's happy at the moment. He's happy. But that's not going to satisfy his need. It's not just the quality that Kehelis is about it. It's the quantity. Interesting is that, I mean, that's why Kehelis mentions the big problem is Misa. Misa is the big problem. But the Eish Yomas HaChacham HaMachseel, and Yisrael, he mentioned that several times. This is something which is Misa is of course the biggest undoing of any kind of sense of self worth. And no doubt that, I mean, that's why the Torah says Kibyama Chochem Menemos Tomas. The Misa was created. Misa by Hashem Kitov Zayama Misa. Misa was created. Because without Misa, that's the price that man had to pay for his chait. The moment he had that chait, now all the energies go into the need for self-worth, for a sense of accomplishment. That need is something which would preoccupy man, and he simply would never be able to remove himself from chait. It would be impossible. There would be no chance for the Bechira to work. It would be virtually impossible. But the antidote is Misa. Misa is the only thing which is needed. That's the antidote. Misa gives a person a chance for the Bechira to work, because it is a quiet voice inside him that tells him that all his strivings are craziness, basically. If that weren't, then Misa is the thing that tells him that. And Eich Yomas HaChochem HaMakseel. No matter what, that's what David HaMelech says in Tehillim Mem Tes, that when he talks about so that's one of the first things he says over there. Of course, Chazal distinguish Chacham Yamusu, Baksil Vayavedu. There's a Nisan and a Neva. The Chsil is totally Neva, but the Chacham dies. But nevertheless, that Kiyira Chacham Yamusu, Yachaksil Vayavedu, Vazul Acherim Chelam, Kirba Batem Aliolam, Mishkinosim Adar Dar. So that's really the antidote. I mean, that's from that fact that it's inescapable, and no matter what lifestyle a person chooses, ultimately it's Misa is the end. That gives him the chance for Bechira. Without that's Kibyam Chochem Menemos Tomas. Without Misa, he wouldn't have a chance. Once all the energies become wrapped up in the need for self-importance, that need for self-importance. So Misa really was something which was a introduced Vayarshem Kitov, Zayom Misa. It became a bracha in an unfortunate way, because he was a chote. There had to be an antidote to the institution that came in existence because of the chait. But interestingly enough, it's it seems it wasn't enough. Because if that were enough, so then why do you have to have Kibamakok men and most Thomas? One would think that, okay, so most Thomas, and now you have the refuah for the taiva is the institution and the need for self-importance, which alerts man with regard to certain kind of averis. It alerts him. But then it itself turns on itself. And he can become preoccupied with that need of self-importance. So the Yoma Misa counteracts that. The Misa is something which is inescapable and places him into reality so that he can exercise his Bechira once more. But and that, by the way, is where Kehelis comes from, of course. Kehelis is on Odom after the Chet, not Odom Kodem Chet, Odom after the Chet. And that's really the entry point of Kehelis. But it's interesting that it seems from the Torah that that wasn't enough. Because if that were enough, you wouldn't have to have the klola for Adam and the klola for the Isha. Interesting. The klola for Adam and the klola for the Isha. Because one, he said, okay, that's it. Now he's a subject to Misa. But apparently that's not enough. What else is there? What else there is the two klolas. And by Adam, by the Isha, Harbo arba etzvonech veironech be'etzav tel divonim ve'lishech shukosech v'yim shobach and into Adam kishamato l'kol ishtecha v'tocha min ha'eitz asher tizdichu nosoch minu aru Adam bavurecha b'itzavon tochalun akol yimei chayecha. It's an interesting thing. But there's one common denominator here that exists in both the Isha and in the Adam. But it's in two different frames of reference. One is insofar as Leda is concerned, and one is insofar as man being productive in his work. You say, what is the one common denominator? And it's in Lashon Mikra. Itzavon. You have the same word. Harbo arba itzvonech veironech be'etzev tel divanim. And by Adam the same thing. Aru Adam bavarecha be'itzavon tochalana kol yimechayecha. See, that one thing is common in both. What is itzavon? Itzavon really means depression. That's what it means. It's not tsar. It doesn't say betzar tel divanim. Harbo arba tzarech. No, it's vonech. The etzev tel divanim. Etzev means a depression. And the same thing by Adam. That aru Adam avarecha be'itzavon tochalena kol yimei chayecha. The term means that with the two instinctual drives of man, and it differentiates between the drive of man and the drive of the woman, that in the woman it's in the maternal and the productive in having children, having offspring, that's where her instinctual drives are greatest. And with man, it's in the drive to accomplish and be productive, agriculturally or whatever the society may be. Basically, it's agricultural, but as society develops, it goes into different spheres, but it's the same thing. But it means that there's a concomitant current of depression that accompanies both of these instinctual gratifications. It's an interesting thing. I mean, that's basically what they're saying. That apparently the Yoma Misa is one thing. The Yoma Misa does offset the fantasy of immortality. But if the fantasy of immortality were rampant, then he would never be able to avoid chet. That would be his complete preoccupation. So that's true. That is true on an intellectual plane. On an intellectual plane, the Yom HaMisa counters any kind of intellectual. That's what the Shlomo Melech says Yosef Das, Yosef Machal. Because the more Das he has, so the more the realization, the more it's real. The more it's real, so the more machal he has, the more pain he has. So that's true. But apparently that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough. Apparently the instincts can rise Mamisa. So there was something necessary to emotionally attack him. It's a side kind of a thing, an emotional thing. Now, what is the emotional thing? The emotional thing is depression. It's an interesting thing. That it was necessary in order for Adam to be placed in a position where he is capable of seeing through the illusions of the institution that was created in order to save him from other kinds of chatayim. What was necessary was that there should be he should have an accompanying current of depression in his accomplishments. By the Isha, it's a depression after childbirth, and that's true psychologically. That a woman has a certain kind of a postpartum, it's called. But that's really what the Torah is talking about. That depression, an emotional depression, which is the source is not even something that the person is aware of. It's from the part of the human mind that he's not conscious of. And that depression, for instance, in the postpartum depression, it's something which just strikes a woman and she feels a sense of worthlessness and depression. And the same thing is true by Adam. Be'itzavon tochalena kol yimecheyecha. That with his accomplishments, there is something unexpected happens, and with his accomplishment, he suddenly starts feeling a sense of depression. So the emotional, apparently what the Torah is describing is that the institution that Adam protects him from the lusty tithes, the institution of that protects him from pure lust, which is the institution of the conscience, you see, is one which is based upon a powerful fantasy of immortality, which is counteracted on two levels. It's counteracted on the intellectual level with the recognition of his own demise and the temporality of his own existence. That's an intellectual affront to his sense of self-importance, you see. But apparently that wasn't enough. Apparently something else was necessary. And that something else was an emotional phenomenon. That an emotional phenomenon of depression, an undercurrent of depression, which emerges at certain points in a person's life, usually at the points, that's what Torah says, the points of when he reaches his so-called goal, whatever goal he may establish for himself, when he reaches that so-called goal, suddenly he's hit by a depression. He eats and he's successful, he attains his goal, but with that goal is some kind of an inexplicable depression that he never unexpected. But just at the moment when he thinks that he would feel the happiest, he suddenly has a deep sense of depression, emotional depression. And the Torah is teaching us is that if it weren't for those two elements, again, I mean, it shows man that how powerful his need for self-importance is, that it has to be counteracted by two forces from two different spheres. One from the intellectual sphere, the recognition of the Alma Misa, and the second is on an... Even that would be overridden. Even that would be overridden. He'd forget about it. He could undergo a philosophical repression when it comes to that fact. But the one thing that keeps him in tune is the emotional, the day-to-day. There must be something that attacks, because the emotions are very short-sighted, and the emotions are overcome by the immediate. I mean, that's why, for instance, Kehelech starts off with Dor Holech V'Dor Ba. Why Dor Holech V'Dor Ba? What's the idea of Dor Holech V'Dor Ba? Dor Holech V'Dor Ba means that if you analyze a thing logically, intelligently, you have to know how much of it to grasp. Okay? You can't, like Aristotle says, if you want to analyze the ocean, you can analyze one drop. That's true when it comes to analyzing the ocean. But when it comes to analyzing areas of knowledge, you have to know how much to encompass, how much forms a unit to analyze. A unit signal. I'm learning a sugya, so you can't just analyze. You could start the main. You can analyze the first word in the Mishnah and analyze the first Rashi and stay there forever. But that would be a very big mistake, because in order to analyze something, you have to know how much of the material do you have to grasp that in order to have enough that lends itself for analysis. And the same thing is true of life. The fool's life is very short-sighted. He only analyzes, his analysis is limited to a very, very short span, the immediate. But Dor Holech V'Dor Bo is the span, the correct span, because that's the correct overview of the topic of man, is to look at what is the topic of man, what is one analyzed man, it's generations. Dor Holech V'Dor Bo. That's the right point. That's the right point of analysis. That's the quantity, the proper quantity that lends itself to an analysis of human existence. Not one day or one month or one year. It's the whole picture, is the picture of man. Is what do you see? And what do you see in the way nature is constructed? That is a Dor Holech V'Dor Bo plan. That plan is implicit. That plan emerges from analysis, not from your emotions, your sense of the emotional. So the Chacham is the one that's able to remove himself from his emotions and to allow the subject matter to give the information. The proper information emerges from the analysis of the subject matter. And then, once he has that information, then he can analyze. But the fool, the shout of the fool, the tipish, is the one, the chfil is the one that basically his determination of the span, that subject to analysis, is based on his emotions. The emotions are very tied to the immediate, to the small, very small world, which basically fades into oblivion very quickly, but his emotions are very attached to it. So his world of analysis, that's the difference in the chassil and the chacham. The chassil's world of analysis is determined by his attachments, his emotional investments, which are very, very small. What happened today in the news? What went on today? What's going on today? That's his world. His world is the world of the immediate and the present, which fades into nothingness over the years. But that doesn't prevent him from using that as the area of his analysis, because of the power of his emotions. So what counteracts that? The attachment to the immediate, that draw, what counteracts that is the tzavon. That's what the Torah says. That the current of depression, which accompanies his day-to-day attachment, and is in the small world, that current of depression is what veers him away from, gives him an opportunity, I should say. It depends on the person's bechirah. But it gives him an opportunity to move away from the force and the power of the immediate. Because the emotions are always attached to the here and now, drawn to the immediate. The immediate is the world of the physical, the world of the psychological, is the immediate. A person enjoys himself, he enjoys himself in a small frame of time. So the attachment is always to the immediate and to the moment, and that causes a person to make a big mistake. The biggest mistake he makes because of that is his concept of happiness. His whole concept of happiness is based on his attachment to a small moment. That's why if you ask a person, what would he want, what does he want if he wants to be happy? What he really is thinking of is not a happiness based on a logical study of what happiness is. It's based on an experiential study. What is experiential? There were moments in his life when he felt great, you see, and he's attached to those moments. So happiness to him is taking those moments and imagining that those moments can be placed back to back throughout his life, you see, stretched out over his life. That's basically what he's looking for. Even in his search for happiness, the idea of happiness is a nonsensical idea. It's nothing more than taking a moment where he had immense pleasure. With a pleasure could depend on the person, pleasure and satisfaction with the self, or it is always tied in satisfaction with self, but it depends on the individual, how his energies are dispersed, whatever it might be. But his concept and his search of happiness is based on his definition of happiness. And his definition of happiness is not based on any intellectual analysis based upon a ideas that emerge from the study itself. It's just based on the experiential. The experiential is the momentary. Just the momentary is the experiential. So his idea of what happiness is a complete flaw. His very idea of happiness is a complete flaw. It's simply taking the idea of an experiential moment of great satisfaction and imagining that this could go on. If this feeling were constant, then he would be very happy. And, of course, even in a superficial analysis, the fact that experience is very high is based on the fact that it's momentary. If it weren't momentary, it wouldn't be high. But that's a logical analysis. So it's intrinsically impossible. The search that man is engaged in is an intrinsic impossibility, because it's based on an idea which is flawed, because his idea is an experiential one, that he had a great moment, and he would like to have always those great moments. But the only reason that moment was great was because the other moments were not great, and that's why that moment really was so packed with energy. But it's a virtual impossibility to have a succession of moments like that. So his search for what he calls happiness, what he thinks is happiness, is an intrinsic impossibility, and it's completely illogical. But it doesn't prevent him from that search, because the emotions are of the moment, and he gets fooled into thinking that the moment could be expanded. But the thing, the antidote to that powerful attraction to the moment, is the Bitzavon. The moment, the woman's maternal instinct is fulfilled at the moment of giving birth, and that would be something which, if it weren't for this, she'd be wrapped up into a great degree, a sense of self-worth. Because, after all, what could give a person more of a self-worth than an actual productivity? It's a powerful, powerful force. You see, the Nachash said to the Yisha, that the Yisim Kawakim, what does Rashi say, what Chazal say? Borei Olamos. So a woman really is a Borei Olamos, in a sense. I mean, she's doing the act which is the most productive, producing human life. I mean, it's something that's done directly through her body. And that would be something which would take her into the sphere of her own self-importance, and would be so self-absorbing that she would not be able to do anything else if it weren't for the fact that harba arba itzvonech v'heronech, the itzavon that's accompanied by the heroyon, the etzev tel divonim, and then the leda is accompanied by a sense of depression, So the depression is what counters the attachment of the energies in the moment. The Yom HaMisa is an intellectual thing, which is also, of course, powerful. It's a quiet voice, but it's a powerful one, because the reality of the mind recognizes it. But you need two types of forces, apparently. The Torah is establishing vibration. You need two types of forces to counter the overpowering force of the need for self-importance. And those two forces are the Yom HaMisa on the intellectual plane, and on the but the energies have a kind of a grabbing effect. They're grabbed by the moment. That the grab of the moment would be so powerful that the intellectual would not be able to have any effect. So the thing that stops the momentary draw is the emotional accompaniment of depression, the current of depression in man. See, that accompanies all of his strivings and his accomplishments. His strivings and his accomplishments. So that is the antidote. So you need two different methods of giving man an opportunity for Bechira. So you see, really, like the Rambam says, what the loss of Adam was the moment he went down from his high station that he was at the time of creation, where he was a free intellectual spirit, able to simply engage himself in chachma and have no need for that sense of self-accomplishment. Maber Al-Shivas Maber Breshes. There'd be nothing to be carried. It would be a beautiful thing, Maber Breshes. He would only feel good thinking about it and seeing the Chachma. But now even the greatest Chacham, even the greatest cosmologist, when he studies it, it is filled with a sense of remorse and sadness. And he can't escape it because of that institution which was placed in his mind. And that institution would basically swallow up man completely if it weren't for two things that counter it. One from the intellectual sphere, which is the Yom HaMisa, and the other, which in spite of the Yom HaMisa, the nature of the energies of man are that they're stuck and they get attached to the immediate. The attachment to the immediate is so powerful that the intellectual would simply have no effect, were it not for the emotional concomitant depression that is always there that weakens the attachment. That's Etzef Tel Divonim by the Isha, and by the man, his accomplishments are always accompanied with the Tzavon Tachalana, the Achila, and accompanied by the Tzavon, by the depression, that stems from a part of him that he's not ready for, he doesn't expect it, and he doesn't know it. But it is something that is always there. Those two elements protect him and guarantee and give him the ability for Bechira. But simultaneously, they guarantee that it is impossible for him to attain psychological happiness. That became impossible. After the Chet, that's a virtual impossibility, and that's basically Sefer Kalis. That's Sefer Kalis. And that's why the conclusion is, Sof Dovah Kol Nishma, like I mentioned before, that's a Lekim Yirav Es Mitzvosav Shemor, Ki Zeh Kol Adam. It is sad, but it's not completely sad. What he's saying is that's the only satisfaction that a person can have. It's a rational satisfaction. Will it really satisfy his underlying need, his underlying psychological force in man for the Yisroel? The answer is no. But it gives him a satisfaction that if he studies and he knows that this is the reality of human life, so then there is a thin satisfaction, but it's also a strong one, that he's living in line with reality. This is the reality of man, and he's living in line with that reality. That's the only satisfaction. That's basically the conclusion. Okay. All right, Rabbi. Okay, we'll stop here. Yes. No, it wouldn't be enough. No, because then the logical would spur him on. I'll get out of this. He would cast aside the Yitzhavon. The other, that's correct. Each one is necessary. They attack him from two different fronts, and each one is necessary.
Really?
Yeah.
Doesn't the Kutz Medardar operate also in the
Torah? Well, the Kutz Medardar is part of the... something. I'm talking about this. Let's not mix everything into everything. I'm talking about this one pasuk. Okay? All right.
Okay. This is my order. Okay. All right. I just wanted to... the area we started last time, I think it was on a Friday last time. Right? All right, we did it on a Friday. So I just wanted to finish off some loose ends from what we did last time. But we mentioned the Kehelas, and there's just something I just wanted to show you about how accurate the Kehelas, the statement in Kehelas is, that and the way Chazal explained that that Kehelas is against against Shivas Mebrachus. So that how man is, there's an interesting thing, by the way, that Chazal, I don't have the Chazal before me, but the Chazal say that on each day they show why it's Havel Havolim. And on the Yom HaShabbos it says, so the Meir says, Yom HaShabbos, what is Hevel in the Yom HaShabbos? So it says, Mechalel Mos Yomos. Strange, why does that make it Havel Havolim? I mean, why does that make it Hevel? But according to the way we interpret it, what the Medrash is saying is very good. because the Havel Avolam of Shlomo HaMelech is that man, when man looks at the universe, he has to say Havel Avolam. In other words, only Hashem could say Kitov. Vayar Hashem Kitov. That's because only God has an objective view of the universe. But man's view is always tainted. It's always tainted with his need for perceiving some kind of a purpose. And that's a part of his nature. And it's after the downfall of Adam. And once that's a part of his nature, so everything, that part of his nature really permeates everything that he does and that he views. And that's why when man looks at the universe, so man becomes despondent, you see. I just wanted to read you from, just to show you how true that is. There's a book that came out a while ago. It's called The First 3 Minutes by Steven Weinberg. By the way, if I mention a book, it doesn't mean that I recommend the book or that I agree with what the book says. I mean, it's insofar as physicists are concerned, their ideas when it comes to anything outside the immediate work that they do in physics, especially when it comes to the area of philosophy, is notoriously bad, very bad. It's like the Rambam explains that a person has expertise in one area. There's no transference, no carryover. But people always assume that there is a carryover. So I will get into something about that at another time. There's an important point that a person should know about this. But yes. I'll get back to that. I'll get back to that later. But what I want to show you is that we're interpreting the Chazal that a human being really can't have an objective view, and he only Vayad Hashem Kitov. Only God can say Kitov. Man will always say Havel Avolam. I just want to show you an amazing corroboration for this. That this book by Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize winner in physics, in the end of the book, where he finally comes to what the ultimate prospects of the universe is, so he gives two possibilities. The possibility of eternal expansion or the possibility of that it will collapse upon itself. An open universe or a closed universe. So I just want to show you. So then he goes into, I'm not going to go into the details, but when he finally comes to the conclusion, I just want to read a few sentences to show you the way he thinks about it. He says, can we really carry this sad story all the way to its end, to a state of infinite temperature and density? Does time really have to stop some 3 minutes after the temperature reaches 1,000,000,000 degrees? Obviously, we cannot be sure. So he goes on to the uncertainties, but I'm not interested in the physics of what he's saying here. But just listen to the way he talks about it. He says, from these uncertainties, some cosmologists derive a sort of hope. You see, it may be that the universe will experience a kind of cosmic bounce and begin to re-expand. But then he goes to show that that's not too helpful either. So in the end, he says, however all these problems may be resolved, and whichever cosmological model proves correct, there is not much of comfort in any of this. It is almost irresistible for humans to believe that we have some special relation to the universe, that human life is not just a more or less farcical outcome of a chain of accidents reaching back to the first 3 minutes, but that we were somehow built in from the beginning. He says, as I write this, I happen to be in an airplane at 30,000 feet flying over Wyoming en route from San Francisco to Boston. Below, the earth looks very soft and comfortable. Fluffy clouds here and there. Snow turning pink as the sun sets. Roads stretching straight across the country from one town to another. It is very hard to realize that this all is just a tiny part of an overwhelmingly hostile universe. It is even harder to realize that this present universe has evolved from an unspeakably unfamiliar early condition and faces a future extinction of endless cold or intolerable heat. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. And then he goes, he concludes very nicely, but if there is no solace in the fruits of our research, there is at least some consolation in the research itself. And then he goes on to say that that human beings are not, men and women are not content to comfort themselves with tales of gods and giants, or to confine their thoughts to the daily affairs of life. They also build telescopes and satellites and accelerators and sit at their desks for endless hours working out the meaning of the data they gather. The effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that lifts human life a little above the level of farce and gives it some of the grace of tragedy, which of course he's moving in a correct way over there, which is Wayadis, the Tzelem Elokim. But I just want to show you how unavoidable it is, even for a person that is top great scientist, to avoid what he's stating basically is in the clearest terms what Kehela says, that when man looks at the universe, he experiences a sadness. Why is he sad? He's not going to be here during that time, but it's hundreds of millions of years away. But the fact is that his view of the universe as a human being is tainted, and he cannot look at it objectively. It's unavoidable. No, it's impossible for man to do that. So, I mean, that's basically what Kehelas is saying. That was it, Dan Kehelas. Vayad Hashem Kitov, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say Kitov. When man looks at the universe, he must feel Havel Avolam, because that part of him that's tied to an idea of accomplishment, he distorts his view, and he's almost thrown into a kind of philosophical depression, you see. Which shows, basically, that another point, which the Rambam always mentions, that a human being is... That's another reason why you have to be very careful. Another reason why a person must be very careful in accepting the words of experts when it comes to any of these areas. Because once you see that man has an emotional view, his view is tainted by emotion, which is part of his nature. So we have a Masorah, that the moment there's an emotion, the chance of arriving at truth becomes very slim. And one must really be a tremendous chacham to be able to sift out that which is true and which is real from that which is brought on by emotional thinking, which is a part of the nature of man that distorts reality. And I just wanted to show you that even the greatest physicists can't escape this fate. The only one, that's why we maintain that's why Maisa Bereishis is such a dangerous thing, because the only one that could really enter into that realm is a person who is a true chacham and understands his emotions and can recognize them and know them and be able to know when an emotion is at play or when it's his mind, when it's his intelligence and his chachma. And that's why Chazal said Maisa Bereishis is reserved for only the very, very few. Only the very few. And even in the area of the science itself, you can't trust the scientists. For instance, I'll just give you an example of something he says. He says, some cosmologists are philosophically attracted to the oscillating model. In other words, that the universe will collapse on itself. Especially because, like the steady-state model, it nicely avoids the problem of Genesis. Okay? Because, you see, that is something which is the problem of Genesis has nothing to do with physics. It has to do with philosophy, you see. And there is no real problem of Genesis. It's only, that's a total mistake. One time maybe I'll just give a class on that to show you how this is a total error and has nothing to do with science, but has to do with philosophy. And it's a mistaken idea which stems from the fact that man, you see, a human being has the ability to be proficient in a science and yet not know the basis of the science. It's an amazing thing. A person can be a great mathematician. That doesn't mean he understands the foundations of mathematics. That's a completely different thing. As a matter of fact, the foundations of mathematics were not investigated even until the past century or two. So you could be an ingenious mathematician. And just like it's possible in Torah as well. A person could learn through, as Rav Chaim said, a person can learn through all the ins and outs of a sugya, know it perfectly, and not know what the basic idea of the sugya is all about. But that's true, and that's true insofar as learning is concerned also. That a person could be a great Talmud Chacham, and yet not understand the foundations of the thinking that is the basis of the limud. And similarly, a person can understand Torah Shebal Peh and Halacha very, very well and not understand the foundations of Yahadus. That is like the Rambam points out. And the famous Rambam Rivet. So you see that foundations is a completely different science. Completely different. So a person that's proficient in a science doesn't mean you should trust him when it comes to the foundations of his very science. As a matter of fact, Weinberg himself, in another one of his books, states that the whole foundations of the quantum are very shaky. They don't really understand it. Doesn't mean that they can't make discoveries. Doesn't mean they can't. They doesn't mean they can't intellectually continue to penetrate further. It's a different science. It's a different mitzvah. Different science. Foundations of a science are not the same thing as the science itself. It's a different kind of a science. And that's why, that's why a person has to be very, very leery. And because people are generally taken in, and they think if a person is a great scientist, they start trusting him. You can't even trust the individual when it comes to the foundations of the very subject that he is a master in. Because that's a different type of a mastery. Okay? A person can have a great intuition, for instance, in giving good definitions. It doesn't mean you could define a definition, what a definition is. It's a different kind of a thing. So that's why in our Masorah, you have to be very, very careful, and that's why Chazal were very cautious when it came to these areas, because people tend to be taken in by the fact that a person is a great mind in a subject. Might be a great mind in a subject, in his area it could be very great, but there's no spillover into the areas that are even the foundations of the things that he is doing himself. So I'll speak about it another time. But anyways, what I wanted to show you was how true the words of Kelos are. And therefore, even when it comes to a cosmologist, you have to know that they themselves are moda, that there are very powerful emotions in these areas, and they guided the human beings. They're guided by emotions. So you really can't trust. You can't trust them. But the only thing, what it takes is a very great chacham who knows, who understands the foundations of Yahadus and the ideas and the correct ideas, and who also is on a level, as I said, that understands the ideas pertaining to man and the nature of man, and who knows how to differentiate between man as an emotional creature, and to identify the emotions and to know where his mind is working and where his emotions are working. That's a different kind of that's a different kind of a science. That's not physics anymore. But what I wanted to just show you was how amazingly accurate the statement of Kehelis is, that the Havel Havolim. That's exactly what Kehelis meant by the Havel Havolim. Okay. I wanted to So what is the idea of the of Shabbos? That Shabbos is a wonderful day, but nevertheless, Mechallel Mosimas. You see, what I think the Chazal mean by that is, again, that you see, what does Mechallel Mosimas have to do with it? The Mefarshim recognize the difficulty. But I think the answer is that the Yom HaShabbos is an unbelievable day, but simultaneously, the fact that the person knows that he's constrained to keep it takes away from the enjoyment of it, you see. In other words, the element of that, and that is something that that is something which is a which it's impossible for the person to avoid. That is, when I say impossible, I don't mean totally impossible. I mean impossible for man on the Kehelis framework. In the Kehelis framework, he's discussing man insofar as he's a psychological creature, you see. He's not discussing a person that has risen above human psychology, like Moshe Rabbeinu, became a Sechel Nifrad. He's discussing man qua Adam. So insofar as man is, insofar as man is a psychological creature, that's what Chazal is saying. That the Yom HaShabbos, it would seem, is perfect. Yeah, but there's one problem. Machala, he knows Machala Mosimos. And that detracts from the element of his nature, which is what psychologists call the superego, is going to give him a source of pain over here because he knows Machala Mosimos. He has to do it, you see. So that's what Kellis is saying, that this element of man permeates every aspect of his existence, and it affects him in every area, and even something which is the Yom HaShvi, which is the most perfect day, but it will creep in even to that, in that day, and will take away from the real Shvisa, of the real Yom HaShvi. Okay. What I wanted to do was, I wanted to just go in a little more into what we started with the Isha, with the curse given to the Isha, and then to the Adam, and then to the Adam. But certain things that we could draw from this. I wanted to just mention the Rambam in the Mora, where the Rambam says. I haven't got the regular one. Thanks. Okay. Yeah, so the Rambam says like this. The Rambam says that he quotes certain Chazal over here. And the Rambam says, this is it's on Genesis. It's chapter 30 in the book two. It's on page 217 in the paperback guide. Okay. So the Rambam says that the ideas with regard to Adam and Chava are the deepest ideas. And he says that they really can't be understood. The ones that open up these ideas are Chazal. And he quotes some of these midrashim. You see, and he says like this. He's very cryptic. He says, yeah. This one, I don't want to take all of it. I'm going to take part of it. He says like this. He quotes a lot of Chazal about Samuel, the measure of Samuel. The serpent had a rider. The rider was as big as a camel. And it was the rider that enticed Eve. The rider was Samuel. Okay. And he goes into that. I just want to show what he's showing is that some of these Chazal, he says it more clearly over here. He says the following, he says like this. The greatest hatred exists between the serpent and Eve. And between his seed and her seed. Her seed being undoubtedly also the seed of man. More remarkable still is the way in which the serpent is joined to Eve. By the way, I want to tell you, his translation is terrible. Friedlander does not understand the Mara. That I could tell you. He has no understanding of the ideas in the Mara. And his translation is really bad. In some places it's horrible. It throws you completely off. Sometimes when I look back at the original, I wonder how he even did it. Translate it. It's strange. But anyways, he says like this. So the Rambam wrote in the letter, he can't trust the translator who just translates words, doesn't understand the ideas. And he says like this. He says, Eve defeats the serpent by crushing its head, while the serpent defeats her by wounding her heel. This is likewise clear. The following is also a remarkable passage, most absurd in its literal sense, but as an allegory contains wonderful wisdom and fully agrees with real facts, as will be found by those who understand all the chapters of this treatise. When the serpent came to Eve, he infected her with poison. The Israelites who stood at Mount Sinai removed that poison. Idolaters who did not stand at Mount Sinai have not got rid of it. Note this likewise. Again, they said, the tree of life extends over an area of 500 years' journey, and it is from beneath it that all the waters of the creation sprang forth. And they added the explanation that this measure referred to the thickness of its body and not to the extent of its branches. For they continue thus, not the extent of the branches thereof, but the stem thereof, has a thickness of 500 years' journey. This is now sufficiently clear. Okay. Again, God has never, this is an amazing chazal, God has never shown the tree of knowledge of good and evil to man, nor will he ever show it. This is correct. For it must be so according to, and here's the wrong translation, it should be according to nature. He has according to the nature of the universe. It has nothing to do with that. They're completely wrong. Okay, what I want to show is that what the thing is that the Rambam goes on, and he mentions more Chazal, and he always says it's clear and it's true. I mean, okay, he doesn't want to really explain it, obviously, to Rambam. But what I want to say, and you're not allowed to give an explanation for the Rambam. You know that. Rambam wrote in his Agdama. You're not allowed to give any explanation. There's no such thing as a pirush. If you see a pirush of the Mora, you know right away it has to be wrong. Because Rambam made an isser on explaining anything in the Mora that he didn't explain. Or you're only allowed to explain things that he quotes from other sources, but you're not allowed to explain anything that he says himself originally. Okay, so what we can say from the Mara is one thing is clear from the Rambam and the Mara, and that is that the ideas of the Eitz Hadas and the early account of Adam really is the thing that unravels it is really the Midrashim. And it's you have to be careful in how you interpret, and it's certainly not the pshuto kamashmo, but the main ideas are beneath the surface. Okay, that's a famous chazal that he's quoting, the chazal that about Maimed Har Sinai, that Hitil Bozuamo, that the Nochosh and planted in the Isha a kind of poison, and Har Sinai, those that stood at Har Sinai, the Zuama was removed, and those that didn't, it wasn't removed. Yeah, just to make a first step in the direction of the explanation of that Chazal, and what is the basic idea that Chazal is saying? The basic idea that Chazal is saying is that Maimar HaSinai was not just an intellectual affect. Wasn't just that we gained tremendous knowledge at Sinai, but it also had an emotional impact that had to do with affecting human nature for those that were present, and for all succeeding generations who accepted who were the heirs to that event. You see, that's really what Chazal is saying on the most basic level. That's what Chazal is saying. And Maimar HaSinai had a powerful emotional effect, and the powerful emotional effect has to do with the state of man. With the Ishan and the Nachash and the Hitul Bozuama and the other nations that weren't at Har Sinai, they didn't have this effect. But that's the basic idea of the Medrash. And Maimar HaSinai had an emotional impact, and the emotional impact was a good one, because what it did was, in the most basic terms, the effect of Sinai was to subdue the instinctual force to a degree. See, just the effect of Sinai. That's what Chazal is saying. That the Samoil, and what the Rambam is saying, and the Hitil Bozuama has to do with the instinctual. It means that the Nachash, the relationship of the Nachash and the Isha, was an instinctual, sexual kind of a phenomenon. It was tied to the instinct. And that Maimed Har Sinai, just being at Maimed Har Sinai, had an emotional effect that subdued the instinctual in a certain way. That's what it means, that Klal Yisrael that were at Har Sinai, they don't have the Zuama. The Zuama is a reference to the activity and force and power of the instinctual. And the Nachash enticed the Isha. The Nachash enticed the Isha, you see. And that enticement was something that affected and gave her a certain arousal. And that arousal was an instinctual arousal. And Marmara at Sinai subdued it. Just the effect of being at Sinai, at seeing the event of Sinai, and all the succeeding generations that accepted Sinai. You see, that's the meaning of the Chazal. Okay, it's like the Rambam says. See, there's one thing I will take from the Rambam, and I don't think the Rambam would be upset with it, and that is where he says that the Chazal that are most absurd in its literal sense is an allegory that contains wonderful wisdom and fully agrees with real facts. That's what the Rambam says. Fully agrees with real facts. Okay? So that's the key. What the Rambam is saying is the key to understanding Maaseh Bereishis, insofar as a person is capable, has to do with understanding real facts. If it gives you insight into real facts, then you know that you're on the right path. If it doesn't, then obviously you're not. So this is what the meaning of the Chazal is on a basic plane. Okay. There's one thing that's very interesting, and I think it's significant in the same sphere, and that is the Nachash. Okay. Really, what was the curse of the Nachash? The curse of the Nachash was Al Gechon Chaselech, correct? So what's the difference if the animal goes on its slides on its stomach or if it has legs? I mean, what is the difference between that? Rashi's raglayim hoyelov and iskatzesu. Yeah, but Rashi really hits it on the head. Now, what is the you see, va'ata tishufenu akev. So Rashi says, lo yehelach koma. You see, koma, height. So what it means is that apparently part of the attraction of the Nachash to the Isha was the fact that the Nachash had height. The Nachash had height. And height is an attractive feature. You see, even today people say he's tall. He's tall, so tallness is an attraction. So apparently, the attraction of the Nachash, or an essential ingredient in his attraction to Chava, was the fact that he had height. He had koma. So Rashi points out. So Al Gechon Chaselech removed one of the attractive features of the Nachash, his height. Okay. You see, by Shaul HaMelech, what was the pasuk mentions? Mishichmo v'malo gavoa mikol ha'am. It was very tall, very tall. Tallness is an attractive feature. By Shaul. It says by Shaul. Mishichmo v'malo. Who does that? Shaul HaMelech, I'm sorry. Shaul. So height is an attraction. So the thing is, so what is that? So what does it mean that the Nachash... The Nachash lost his height. That's how Gechon Chaselech is the opposite of height. It means he had no height. Okay, he went to the opposite extreme. He had no height. So what is the significance? What difference does it make if the Nachash really today's Nachash, if the Nachash would have height or if he wouldn't have height, what difference does it make? I mean, in today's, that's the next question that you're going to be bothered with. What's the difference if the Nachash? So today's Nachash would make a difference if he had legs or didn't have legs. What is the purpose? You see? What's the answer? See, the fate of the Nachash, and that's why the Rambam mentions these Maimori Chazal, because the fate of the Nachash was that